the last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
As I was saying, John Gibbons is on a well-deserved holiday. So Sive O'Neill is with us, the climate environmental researcher who is a contributor to the Irish Times. And Sive, the first thing I want to ask you about is this report published this week from the Climate Change Advisory Council about coastal erosion and the possibility that we're going to lose a lot of properties and road over the next 20 to 25 years. Tell us all about this, please.
Yeah, this is a report written by an expert from the University of Galway, Eugene Farrell. But the thing I would say about it is that this is a report that the council have published. They haven't issued any statement endorsing its recommendations. I think that's an important point because there are really important things in this paper. So Dr. Farrell highlights the fact that we have about 4,500 properties and up to 354 miles of road that are at risk of being lost to the sea over the next 25 years. And that could only accelerate if climate change accelerates. So basically about 40% of our population lives within 5 kilometres of the coast. And another 40,000 people live within 100 metres of it. So the potential loss, if the coast is eroding like that with rising seas and stronger storms that are doing damage to the coastline, is potentially immense. And what he highlighted in the report was the fact that we don't have any response in place and we should be talking about relocating people. We should be looking at models that are being used in other countries to figure out what to do and to figure out where we need to provide for a managed retreat from coastal areas, and obviously setting aside the resources to support people in doing that, because it's not something that we can make go away by just talking about it. We actually have to have the money in place and to actually do it. And there isn't really an engineering solution. You know, everybody's aware of the strength of the waves coming in from the Atlantic, and there's absolutely no way that we can use engineering solutions to protect the coastline everywhere.
In relation to those houses, Sive, I wonder how do they manage even to get home insurance to protect against damage? And if these people look to sell their properties, would anyone be in a position to buy them? Would they be able to get a loan or insurance if they were to purchase those properties?
Yes, I mean, that's a very good question. I suspect that the insurance companies have mapped the country very closely for flood risk, and that these maps aren't necessarily the same maps that are being used by the OPW and by local authorities. So the data is not necessarily publicly available, and homeowners probably only find out when they actually go looking for insurance that they can't get it. One thing that people can and should do is go to a website called Climate Central, and it's basically an interactive tool that allows you to look at the effect of sea level rise on a particular location. So you put in the details of where you live, and it can tell you under 1.5 degrees of warming, 2.5, whatever, you know, what the likely impact of that would be on that particular place. And it's obviously, you know, a bit of speculation, like there's good models behind it. But, you know, people have to do their own homework to find out the extent to which they might be at risk. And unfortunately, our public authorities are not engaging with the public. They're not, you know, getting out and talking to people, and they're not putting in place planning frameworks and resourcing frameworks and also, you know, water management systems to reflect the dire crisis that we could be facing into in the future.
Yeah, and it's interesting though, that's for individual homeowners, but local authorities and the National Roads Authority presumably have responsibilities for the 570 kilometres of road identified. And if anyone has been dismissive of that, I suppose we can point out the issues that we've had, for example, on the train line going down the east coast to Greystones and beyond.
Absolutely. One very severe bout of weather can do terrible damage to road surfaces, including ones that are fairly recent. But the less better, that sort of the poorer road surfaces can be completely washed away. I mean, we've seen that in recent years with severe weather events, how catastrophic the damage can be. And then, you know, the costs of that have to be planned for. In terms of the National Roads Authority, TII, I just have have to say I'm actually a member of the board of TII, and it does have, you know, an adaptation strategy. But we only look after the national roads and motorways. So local authorities have to have the resources in place to do road repairs on the minor roads, many of which are in those coastal areas. You don't get many motorways along the coast.
Okay, something else that's come up this week has been in relation to habitat destruction in Ireland, that apparently it has almost doubled without any increase in prosecutions. These are figures that have been obtained by the Social Democrats TD Liam Quaid from the National Parks and Wildlife Service. Tell us a bit more about this.
Yes, I think this is a very interesting example of how important enforcement is and how more and more reports are being made by members of the public of various incidents involving, for example, hedgerow removal, illegal peat extraction, unauthorised drainage work and land clearance, that kind of thing, and damage obviously to protected habitats and tree felling as well.
And burning of land and vegetation, which is a popular one as well, isn't it?
It is. It's an, and it's extremely serious in terms of its impact on wildlife and the potential for the fire to spread as well. But the interesting figure that Liam Quaid was able to get from the National Parks and Wildlife Service is that while they received 300 reports in 2021, that number has increased quite dramatically to 581. So it's nearly doubled. And it's likely to continue to rise as the public gets more aware of how to report wildlife crime.
Yeah, but does that then lead to prosecutions? Yeah,
that's right. So there isn't really an uptick in the number of prosecutions, which is really very alarming. And he queried them as to whether this was a resourcing issue, like have they got the capacity, the staff? Is there a particular problem in certain areas where staff haven't been recruited? And they wouldn't give that information, which I think, I mean, they argue that it's for their own operational reasons, but it does, I think, point to a lack of transparency, as Deputy Quaid said. And, you know, for example, in his own county, Cork, which is a huge county, and there's been lots of different issues going on there in recent years, they've only had 10 prosecutions since 2021, six in that year of 2021, none in 2024, and just one in 2025. And that just does not tally with our experience as individuals of wildlife crime. And it can be small scale stuff. But the thing is, if we turn a blind eye to it, and if the authorities are turning a blind eye to it, that is habitat loss, that's destruction. And the cumulative effect of that is really very serious. And, you know, we have lots of reports, citizens' assemblies, various strategies in place. We're all supposed to be improving biodiversity. We're supposed to be going in the other direction. We're supposed to be restoring nature and protecting our habitats because they're under so much threat from various different sources. So the fact that the enforcement activity is not, you know, keeping up pace with complaints is extremely worrying. And it's great that Deputy Quaid raised it. I think the follow on thing now is to bring them before the relevant committee in the Oireachtas and quiz them as to what's actually going on.
Saif, I suspect, though, that the majority of landowners do want to protect and care for their land, mainly farmers and whatever. But there is a minority who might think it's my land, I'll do whatever I want with it.
Well, that may be the case, but we do have codes of good agricultural practice. And there are, you know, farmers are aware of what is legal and what is not legal. Hedgerow removal can only be done at certain times of the year, etc. Very often, you know, people claim to be ignorant of the law when in fact they're just taking a chance. And, you know, legal peat extraction is a highly profitable business. It's not being done out of ignorance.
Okay, we're going to have a big preview of the World Cup after 6 o'clock, which starts this evening. But you've had a little bit of a look at the climate cost of this expanded World Cup, because given that it's on three countries, Canada, Mexico, the United States, but spread over those three countries, it means an enormous amount of travel, not just by the teams, but by supporters as well. What are the implications of that?
Well, I have to say, I'm the sort of person who pays no attention to the World Cup until the day it actually starts. But I am looking forward to watching some of the matches. What was interesting about this report is that researchers have calculated that because of the extra large number of teams participating, I'm looking for the figure, but it's been expanded apparently. There are more matches, more teams, and then obviously more fans. So in comparison to the last World Cup in Qatar, they're now expecting the total climate impact of this World Cup in the United States and Mexico and Canada to be 7.8 million metric tons of carbon dioxide, which is absolutely staggering. And that's the equivalent of about 1.7 million cars. And it will be the most polluting World Cup ever staged. So unfortunately, it makes me feel rather guilty even thinking about watching a match, because it's not even just the travel. And most of those emissions, by the way, are to do with the fans traveling to the various matches. And some teams, if they go through the various stages, the fans will have to literally travel from Mexico to the United States, various different cities in the US and to Canada even as well. So there's a lot of travel internally just to keep up with the matches if the teams are successful.
Well, I'll just give you one example. Sorry, the England fans and the England team. We'll be discussing later how the England team may be disadvantaged by the locations of the games, all the travel they have to do. Group games in Dallas, Boston and New Jersey in three games. That just simply doesn't make sense. It's 1,720 miles the team and fans will have to travel. And I think the team is based in Kansas.
Yeah, that's mad altogether. I mean, I'd suspect that the people organising and scheduling the group games are not paying any attention to the distances. They just, you know, organise it around other logistical requirements and whatever stadia are available and so on. But the effect of all of that, the scaling up of all that travel, when you add in the fans, God bless them. I mean, it has to be, you have to support your team, I get it. But it's an awful lot of travel and it's going to lead to a lot of emissions from aviation, from air travel. So we also have an extra 16 teams in this World Cup, which is great. But at the same time, you have to put a question, well, is this really sustainable? I mean, if we're going to get FIFA along the same kind of pathway towards net zero emissions that the Olympic Committee is on, the International Olympic Committee is trying to reduce its emissions in terms of how it plans events and schedules everything. You would have to ask the question whether that extra 16 teams is the right thing to be doing. I'll be supporting Curaçao. It's just amazing that that tiny island is going to be in the World Cup.
But well, you probably won't have too long to be supporting them far, but there you go. So I have one other thing I want to ask you about is Denmark, new government in Denmark, and it has made an enormous amount of environmental commitments. How many of these would you think would be relevant to us here in Ireland?
Well, they're all relevant. So it's a very interesting development because there's a lot of pressure on European environmental policy. And, you know, generally speaking, it's going in the wrong direction. There's a lot of talk of simplification and, you know, watering down the climate and environmental agenda. But the new Danish government's programme claims to be the greenest ever government programme. And they have displaced, they have gotten rid of their Minister for Agriculture and replaced it with a Minister for Nature and Animal Welfare to drive its agricultural reforms, which were initiated under the last government, in fairness, so there's a continuity there. They are proposing, if they haven't already done so, to introduce a carbon tax on livestock emissions. And they're dedicating 15% of their current arable land to be dedicated for nature restoration, new forests and restored carbon-rich peatlands. And they've a whole range of things, you know, that are designed to be, you know, popular, like, you know, free public transport for young people, removing VAT on fruit and vegetables to promote healthy diets and sustainability and so on. But they're basically charting a course towards being a kind of a green industrial economy at a time when many nations are kind of pulling back from that, even that green growth kind of agenda. And obviously the US is the worst of them. But it's very interesting that Denmark is offering this kind of leadership at a time when, you know, there really is not a coherent or effective response coming from either European member states or the international community to the climate and environmental crisis. So it's a welcome development.
Denmark, of course, being the country which has the responsibility for Greenland, which Donald Trump wants. I have to say to you, though, Sive, I cannot see the day when Ireland would replace the Minister for Agriculture with a Minister for Nature and Animal Welfare. It just isn't something that any government is likely to do in this country.
I think we should be asking why.
Because of all the votes of farmers and all the people in the agribusiness.
And
the power that they have in rural constituencies. Votes.
They have an outsized influence on policy and politics. And it's not about the number of farmers. It's about how they use their influence to try to broaden their political constituency to include all rural Ireland. And anyway, we could talk about that all day long, but they are very clever, but they're not representative.
Okay. 0874100102 gives you the last word by text or by WhatsApp. Sive O'Neill, climate environmental researcher and contributor to the Irish Times. Thank you for filling in for John Gibbons today.
The last word with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.